I don't believe criminality is necessarily a bad thing, especially when, if we're talking about like what white people or Europeans dictate as criminal. They're the biggest criminals in the history of the world. You know what I'm saying? We can't take our morality from them at all.
This is Writer's Mosaic, in conversation. Colin Grant talks to author Moses McKenzie about writing his debut novel.
Here I am in Bristol with Moses McKenzie. He's written his first book, An Olive Grove in Ends, and there's very little biography material in the back of Moses' book, but I'll read it anyway. Moses McKenzie is of Caribbean descent and grew up in Bristol, where he still lives and writes full-time. An Olive Grove in Ends is his first novel. So, Moses, can I just begin by getting you to give us a sense of your time here, because you were born in Easton as well, were you? Or whereabouts in Bristol were you born?
No, I wasn't born here. I was born to my mum, who had my older brother, in Cornwall.
In Cornwall, okay.
Yeah, Liscard, a mining town.
Right.
So I lived there for 6 years.
Right.
Yeah.
What are your memories of it?
My memories are mostly good. My experience was mostly bad.
Yeah.
Because, so it's early 2000s, racism was very much, well, PC culture didn't exist. So obviously there's still the same racist values now, but back then they were very, they're expressed much more violently or outwardly.
And how would that have affected you, do you think, as a six-year-old boy?
I think it's interesting because we lived with my grandparents to begin with, and they were like a blessing, the biggest blessing ever, my mum as well. And then we had like a few family friends or family members who were like safe havens. But then anything outside of that was the opposite.
Yeah.
And then we moved, so from Cornwall was probably, I don't know statistically actually, but it would definitely be one of the whitest counties in the country. And then we moved to East, to Easton. I went to primary school in Poles, the area next to Easton.
St. Paul's. Yeah, yeah.
The area next to Easton. And there was like no white people in my primary school, barely any white people in my area. So I went from like the most negative experience of people to the most positive experience of people, being white people and black people. So that has very much defined, shaped my entire life. Very clearly as well, with no subtlety. It's shaped a lot of my opinions and my outlook.
So you're 23 now, and you've got a very engaging title. Maybe you could unpack it for us. An Olive Grove in Ends. I think I know what that means, but what do you mean by the title?
So it's peace in Ends, so peace in neighbourhood, to put it in plain standard Queen's English. An olive grove, taken from the biblical understanding of an olive or what an olive represents, God's promise or covenant was when a dove delivered an olive branch to Noah after the flood, which signifies peace, and then Ends is what, as it says in the early chapters of the book, is what we call our, when I say we, I mean black people from here. Or not even necessarily black people, anyone living in what the media would describe as like rough or dangerous areas or lower income areas. That's what we call Ends. Yeah, so it's peace in Ends.
And peace is what everybody yearns for, especially the main character, I suppose. Now, when I approached you and we were talking about meeting and reflecting on your work, I said, what other writing did you have that I could have a look at to give me a sense of your evolution as a writer? You said there hadn't been any, but when I read the book, it obviously feels very accomplished. So there must have been a few run-ups or rehearsals.
there were three manuscripts. I wrote a play as well. And I wrote a screenplay as well,
yeah.
All before this is published. But they all, and they all got better. Actually, no, that's a lie. My third book was probably worse than my second. But they were all attempts to varying levels of quality.
When you say to varying levels of quality, who did you have to bounce off ideas with? Did you have any mentors?
No, I'm talking very much like it's have internal locus of control, you know what I'm saying? It's very insular. I'm talking about my own opinion of my own work. But I sent them out, I sent the manuscripts out to agents, and they'd respond, and some would even give like short, like little feedback, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But it was mainly just me. I'm looking at it and saying, this is dead, this is good.
Yeah, yeah. And how did you arrive at the idea that you wanted to be a writer? Where did that come from, do you think?
So I started writing in 2017.
Mm.
Yeah, 2017.
5 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I think I'd always liked the English language because I'd always loved music.
Mm.
And that's what I very much grew up on. More than television or film, I grew up on music. So that's where my love of the English language came from. And then obviously when you're writing bars all the time, you're writing lyrics, and you'll bring them to your friends and you'll rap with each other or to each other. So I think my love of English was always there. My appreciation of art was always there. My dad is a photographer. So I think it was just a kind of like a natural step. I read a lot as well, especially when I was younger. I read a lot of fiction.
Yeah.
And then the older I've got, the less fiction I've read and the more non-fiction I've read. Yeah. I don't know. It kind of came out of the blue as well, in a sense, because I hadn't written anything before.
Yeah.
Or expressed anything. I just, the first thing I wrote was a novel, which was dead, but that was the first thing I wrote.
There's always a tension, isn't there, between you as a writer trying to realise something, reaching for something, which is elusive, and the end result. And I just wonder how you feel about the intention behind An Olive Grove in Ends and the result. Are you satisfied?
Yeah, I had two intentions really. One was a love letter to my area, to Eastern, and the other was a love letter to my little cousin, and it is both of those things.
Why to your little cousin?
Just he grew up in the road behind me. We're not related, like it's not blood cousins, but he grew up in the road behind me. I'd come home from school, he'd be just always be in my house. A few years, I think like five years younger than me, 4 years younger than me. I don't like to preach. You know, a lot of people live a certain way around here, but I don't like to preach to people. People change when they're ready to change it, no other time.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted something there that he could read, reflect on whenever, at any stage in his life, whenever he wants to, something we could talk about, something we could break down, you know what I'm saying? A lot of people can't afford to be like particularly reflective in places like this. Well, in a lot of places, they can't afford to be reflective. But it was just so it was there. For him.
Mm-hmm.
And the book's dedicated to him.
Yeah. So Seon has a vision, and his vision is to buy a house atop the hill.
Mm-hmm.
What does that represent for him?
It's heaven. It's heaven. It's like the phrase that I had in my mind a lot was like having your own like little slice of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, it's an area called Clifton,
mm-hmm.
Which is where the suspension bridge is. And yeah, it's heaven. It's not particularly. It's not that subtle. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. It's kind of Zion.
Yeah. Exactly.
So this is an area. This is the house that he would not really, given his background, be able to afford. So he yearns to have that, and it's going to be transformative for him.
Yeah. I was talking to one of my brethren's mum the other day, and she was I gave him one of the proofs, and she started to read it as well.
Yeah,
and we were chatting about the first time that we went to Clifton, and how everyone remembers, like, you know what I'm saying, it was a thing. And when you go there from here and you go up into, it's literally a hill, you go up the hills,
yeah,
and you get to Clifton and you see the suspension bridge, you just think this is a different world. And I think everyone has had that moment, or to be honest, there's actually people, like a few of my peoples, whatever, that have never been, you know what I'm saying, they've lived there their whole lives,
really?
But it's just they don't think to go because it's not for them.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? There's nothing there for them.
Mm.
But
it's not part of their psychological map.
Yeah, it's not. But whenever anyone does go, it's a moment. So I think Seon idolises that and becomes entranced by it.
How do you get hold of his name?
Seon. I pick names that I think are pretty. You know what I'm saying? Pretty sounding, pretty to say, pretty to read.
Mm.
I don't like bland names, do you know what I'm saying? Most of the names in the book, the majority of them are not names in my world.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? I don't have brethrens called Seon.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of them, like Jamal, Najmal, obviously, I have people called that, but most names I don't.
In your piece on finding ideas and artists who have inspired me, you say, my opinions became the spine of the novel, its essence and themes, and I started to create characters to carry them through the narrative. So what were the opinions that became the spine of the novel?
I would actually have, if I open my laptop, I'd have like a couple of sentences, if I was able to find the original plan of what they were, almost like statements of intention.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm writing my third book now, I'm planning my third book now. And I have like five or six like statements that are the themes. For An Olive Grove and Ends, it was mainly about morality and compassion and who is afforded compassion within religion. And then even within society, but mainly to do with God. A question I think will be in my work for the foreseeable future, but maybe forever, is just the idea of at what age are we held accountable? Because, you know, we say a child was still sat and say it's just a child. Someone might say boys being boys or da-da-da. But then at what age is it that person's fault? You know what I'm saying? Because, again, with a child, we'll look at their parents and we'll say they weren't raised right or da-da-da-da. They're bad, bro. It's the parents, it's the family, it's the household. But then at what age does that person become accountable for their actions? It's very interesting. Even within religious texts, I don't think there's any consistency in answering that. Well, at present, I don't believe in the idea of destiny as ordained by God, or something I struggle with. Let's say it rather than I don't believe, something I struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
What I think seems to make more sense is like that saying, the way you're raised, and this is even before, whilst in the womb, you have experiences in the womb, the generational transmission of traumas outside of the womb, you know what I'm saying? So these things affect your life from, very early stage. Like you said, that ties in to the question and to the themes of the book, which also then links to both our punishment, and this is what the book deals with, our punishment on earth, but that's lesser in the book, it's more concerned with our punishment after death.
It's interesting to say, because I was thinking of Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky when I was reading the book. In a way, there's also a very strong love story between Seon and Shona, who find each other at a very early age, don't they? They're just teenagers, or even younger.
Younger children.
In a way, they're kind of mirrors of each other, because they both have pastors who are heads of the family. They both have religion that runs through their lives, like water, I suppose. But one comes from seemingly a kind of respectable side of Bristol or Caribbean life, and the others are the Hughes, who, as you say, every hospital knows the Hughes because they run with each other and they cause mischief.
Mischief, yeah.
For want of a better word. So, in a way, is the journey of the book, the journey of the possibility of Seon finding another path?
Yeah, I have my opinions and I have the characters and the plot.
Mm.
So it is that, him trying to find whoever he can, which is never answered.
Because his dream to get a top of the hill is going to require some money, and the way he does it is to sell drugs. Or sell food, as it's called in the book. And he recognises that kind of moral dilemma, doesn't he, in terms of the revelation of it to his girlfriend?
Yeah, which I think is interesting writing it, because, like I said, I think a lot of people don't reflect on things like this, you know what I'm saying? Or they'll stop themselves reflecting on things like this, whereas obviously I can't have my character not. Well, I could, but it would be a very different book. For example, if the main character was Cuba, the book would read more like Cormac McCarthy's Child of God, where we're supposed to empathise with a necrophiliac, which we don't, but we're supposed to. Or like Native Son.
Richard Wright.
Yeah. Who'd read more like that. Whereas I wanted to go more, and this is again just shaped by the fact that I just wanted to express my opinions, is more like, Seon's more like a flaneur.
What do you mean by that?
He's very ponderous, you know what I'm saying? The first draft of this was more meandering, and I think that's what I'm more inclined to write. It's more like a meandering plot. That's more to do with the themes.
Yeah, I was very drawn to it because it shows the kind of the complexity of a moral life or an immoral life, but also shows that nothing is that straightforward.
I don't believe criminality is necessarily a bad thing, especially when, if we're talking about like what white people or Europeans dictate as criminal. They're the biggest criminals in the history of the world. You know what I'm saying? We can't take our morality from them at all. So selling weed, I don't even look at as a criminal offence. You know what I'm saying? And even as soon as they're able to monopolize weed, it will become legalized. I think it's far less harmful than like alcohol, for example. Sure. Whereas like obviously the other hard food is life threatening. There's life consequences.
Heroin and cocaine.
Exactly.
You're also commenting on gentrification and how Easton is changing. And at one point you say, the character says, it's like mini Mogadishu and little Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, it's been overrun by proper white people. Who are the improper white
people? White people. Improper white people are white people with black children.
Right.
White people with drug addictions and hippies with dreads.
Right.
Because that's who was here, you know what I'm saying? Even when I first came, I was here in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Those white people were here.
Yeah.
They were like a very small minority.
Yeah.
But they were here and no one cared that they were here. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But when I say proper white people, I mean like if you look at the house prices now, they're nuts. And people I can't afford to live in my own area. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's happened in the last 10 years. And we watched it happen. It might be a result of the media narrative of the area. 2011, they published an article saying Stapleton Road is the most dangerous road in the country.
Really?
Yeah. Started going into detail saying today it was a nonsense article. And then now it's chic. You know what I'm saying? They got plant shops. We're in the studio, St. Mark's Road, which is the road we're off now, Mivart Street's off St. Mark's Road. St. Mark's Road was the first road, I'd say, to be gentrified. And then now we've got, in the bottom of the studio, there's like a vegan, whole foods type thing. And it's just mad. You go in there, the prices, you can't buy nothing for less than £3. You know what I'm saying? Everything else is, it's ridiculous.
And when you say in your essay, your allegiances are to those kids you grew up with, it's not to say it's not a geographical location. It's about the connection between these individuals.
Yeah, which will articulate as a connection to the location. Do you know what I'm saying? So I'll say I love East, which is Eastern. I'll say I love it. And I do love it. But when I say that, I'm talking about the memories that I have. And all the memories I have are of people. You know what I'm saying? As opposed to like, the physical place.
So let's talk a little bit about the language, which I thought was great. I was wondering the degree to which you had to argue to include the language in the way that it is written for people who won't be familiar with it. So, I mean, I also say that I do kind of home counties, Jamaican patois. I can write it. I can't necessarily read it. But here's a line. I expect me for by yard in Clifton. You think say me Caucasian? So I get that, obviously. I can read that. Was there any arguments you had with your editors about the language that you used in the book?
Not arguments. The points were raised quite often about it being alienating.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something I was particularly willing to compromise on.
Yeah,
because my target audience is, I write for black people.
So how did you win that discussion? If it wasn't an argument, what was the winning?
It was the fact of who my audience was.
Yeah.
And I was very certain about who my audience is, was and is. And
you say in your essay, your audience is first black.
Diasporic.
And then by black diasporic. Yeah. Right.
Well, black diasporic mainly. And that's simply because there is a distinction between those of us who are raised abroad and those of us who are raised at home, wherever home may be. Do you know what I'm saying? There's a distinction. That's an acknowledgement of that distinction. There's cultural differences, even within blackness. One of the points I made was how you'll read like Kate Chopin, The Awakening, and there's French in there, and Latin. I don't speak French or Latin, do you know what I'm saying? But we're just supposed to understand, there's no glossary. There's no anything in the back that breaks down what the French means. Because she's writing for her particular audience, which is upper-class white people, they just got it. Because those upper-class white people would speak those languages, or at least have an English literary understanding of those languages, you see what I'm saying? And the people I write for will have an understanding of patois, or they'll have an understanding of how black British people use slang.
So when I first started to think about getting published, I'd go into an acquisitions meeting in Penguin Random House, and there'd be 12 people sat around the table, and they listened to the proposal, and said, yeah, Marcus Garvey, dramatic story, well told, great range in terms of the kind of ideas he's reaching for and articulating, but no commercial prospects.
That's
what they said to me. So in other words, you're writing this bloody book about Marcus Garvey. Who's,
no one cares.
Who's going to buy it? Do you have that?
No, I think I'm a beneficiary of yourself. You know what I'm saying? Of Sam Selvman, of George Lamming. I'm a beneficiary of all black writers and artists who's before me. And I very much acknowledge that. But I'm also a beneficiary, even more closer, of the media narrative again surrounding George Floyd's death. You see what I'm saying? Because I went, that happened while we're going out to publishers. And I think that genuinely helped because, like you said, all these lot care about is money. You know what I'm saying? It's a capitalistic world. Everyone just wants to make a profit on the last profit. And if blackness is the trending topic, then blackness sells. If you had come to them with that Marcus Garvey topic after George Floyd died, they would have loved it. You know what I'm saying? So I know that, yes, I think the book is a very good book. However, if I had tried to publish it 20 years ago, I would have got a solid no. No commercial prospects. Yeah, but that's why I think you should always write for your people. And you should always have a target audience in mind, because if I drop a book, my people are going to buy the book. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. What I appreciate about your writing, Moses, is that you're not shying away from difficult subjects. You're not shying away from violence, but you're not encouraging people to be a voyeur on the violence, because the violence is actually mute. I mean, people will suffer violence, but you're not depicting it graphically. You made that conscious decision?
Yeah, definitely. Because like I said, we've seen these stories before, do you know what I'm saying? If I'm you familiar with Top Boy?
Yeah.
So Top Boy is set, by and large, in the same world that this book is set, but it's just coming from two different angles, articulating the same place. For example, like, power is articulating the same place as Boys in the Hood. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But it's just coming from two different approaches, and my approach was more, I want to get into the character as opposed to the violence. Like, it's not a mafia book.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? It's literary fiction. It's not commercial fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, I loved a lot of the characters. I wonder whether you have a favourite.
So Cuba is Seon's cousin, same age. He's dark-skinned, very dark-skinned, which is because it touches on colourism without going into colourism. But Cuba is a walking contradiction. Like, his actions are all out of love, but it's a very selfish love. Do you know what I'm saying? It's an alienating love. It's a love that completely consumes him. It's love for his cousin, the only person in his family who hasn't treated him differently.
Mm.
And then everything he does, all the coldness that he perpetuates, is in order to achieve Seon's dream. He doesn't believe himself because he's internalized his own... His family's hatred of him. Or not hatred, but just the othering of him.
Mm.
He doesn't believe himself worthy enough to have a dream. And then his own outlook, just from being raised here, is most people can't attain their dreams. It takes a special person to attain their dreams, and he believes that special person is his cousin. So I love that character because of his selflessness, you know.
Mm. Well, that's borne out in the phrase, only some people could make it out of our world. It's quite a chilling sentence, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that a reality, would you say, in this?
Yeah, definitely. I think some people's, like I was talking about, what I was saying before, I think people's lives are written, not in the sense, I believe, of destiny, but in the sense of, if you're raised in a certain environment, you're going to be a certain way. You know what I'm saying? If you come from a certain kind of home, if you're shown how to love in a certain kind of way, then that's how you're going to love.
I wonder whether that's informed your writing, because there's a line also in the book, my environment had created in me a unique sensitivity towards tension.
Yeah.
And I feel that you, as a writer, handle that really well, tension throughout the book.
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah, I'd imagine so. I would imagine so.
And also there's a real, I mean, we're coming towards the end now, but there's a real tension, isn't there, as to where you are best placed to lay your hat with Christianity or with Islam. And it reminds me of, do you know Edward Wilmot Blyden?
Yeah, I read his book, Negro Christianity.
Yeah. So he's saying more or less, in summary, that Islam is the best place for the black man.
Yeah. I thought that was an interesting book.
And so Hakim is proselytizing, isn't he?
Yeah.
On behalf of
Islam,
the Muslim religion.
Yeah. I think that's one of the most interesting things I'd say about the book, is the relationship between Christianity and Islam and then race.
Yeah.
Because in Bristol, outside of the book, I think Bristol is the only, or at least one of the only cities where there are more black people than Asians. And the majority black population in Bristol now are Somalis. Before it was Jamaicans. So that means then the majority of black people in the city are Muslim. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that then has a very interesting effect on the Jamaican community, mm-hmm. because there are so many reverts, myself included.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. Not convert, but revert.
Yeah, revert, convert, it's the same thing. So there's Muslims who believe that we were all born Muslim. So they say revert.
Right.
Then there's Muslims who believe it's unnecessary, so just say convert. But yeah, just habit, revert. I think that relationship is very interesting, and it's almost always young Caribbean men from environments like this. And I think it's so interesting as to why that is the case. It's just there's a comfortability that I feel within Islam that I didn't feel within Christianity. You know what I'm saying? But my journey to Islam is different to Sayon's journey to Islam.
Sure.
Sayon's journey is a lack of discipline. You know what I'm saying? A lack of structure, which we all need in some ways. And that's what Islam provided. Hakim, first and foremost. And then Hakim, his older cousin, through proselytizing all the time, has brought him into it. And then also his brethren, Elia, as well.
And do you feel, through your religion and through your background, any kind of moral responsibility when you write?
Yeah. But I don't feel a responsibility towards Islam, more to myself, because I'll have opinions or views that don't align with Sunni Islam, for example. So I feel a responsibility to be true to myself, even when disagreeing with what I am outwardly.
Yeah. Can I just finish by asking you about something we spoke about before I turned on the microphone? And I mentioned that Writer Mosaic was this porous organization where we are going to be essentially promoting writers of the global majority.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't take to that phrase.
Yeah, now I see global majority is the same as BAME and POC, or personal colour. Yeah. It's not something I identify with at all.
Because
I just don't feel a commonality or kinship with non-black people, regardless of whether they're European or Asian.
Oh, so you only feel a kinship with black people?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's, again, because of... This is the thing, it's not just the life.
But do you not feel kinship with your mother?
I think that's an interesting thing, something that me and my mum will talk about, you know what I'm saying? I love my mum wholly, without condition, you know what I'm saying? But my mum has... I think it takes a special kind of white person to raise a black child to have a consciousness. And in part, I empathise with them because they have to kill a part of themselves in order to correctly raise a black child, or what I perceive to be correctly raise a black child. So people will call me mixed race, or before it used to be dual heritage or whatever. I'm sure it will change again. My mum immediately from the offset has raised us, you're not mixed race, you're black. There's no white in you type thing. So she's in me in the sense of she's raised me, do you know what I'm saying? I'm her in so many ways.
Yeah.
But there is no whiteness in me. So I love my mum. And then if I generalize white people as a whole, I don't have love for white people as a whole. Do you see what I'm saying? And there's a number of white people that I love. Do you know what I'm saying? There's a number of Asian people that I love. When I walk down the street, my prejudice is not a violent prejudice. My prejudice is not, I don't want to be brethren with that person because they're this and that. My prejudice is wariness.
You're wary.
I'm wary. And again, that's founded in fact. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Anecdotally, within my experience, my friend's experience, my family's experience, but then historically, for hundreds and hundreds of years, which is difficult for anyone to argue with. Do you know what I'm saying?
How does that wariness work out when you're writing for a publisher that is populated by white people?
it works out by ignoring that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It works out by me just writing for myself.
Yeah.
And then if they don't understand something, I'll break it down. I'm not an educator. I don't want to be walking around explaining what race is and da 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 to white people. I think that's their own job. They should educate themselves, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But because the relationship between a writer and an editor, the writer and an agent, in some sense is quite intimate.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually need them to understand in order to make sure, in order so they can criticize me in terms of my work.
A final question.
Mm.
What have you learned from writing An Olive Grove in Ends that is going to help you with your new book?
I've learned that plotting is not my natural strong suit. I got my themes down. The way I articulate my themes is good. My voice is good. My characters are strong. But my plot, and I think it's more a matter of concern, you know what I'm saying? I'm less concerned with my plot, but I need to be more concerned with my plot. So that's the main thing that I've learned.
And how's the plotting going for the new book?
Second or third? Both.
Both, yeah.
Yeah, so the second one, I think that I was more focused on the plot. And the third one, I'm just going to plan to death. You know what I'm saying? I'm just going to know everything that happens.
Yeah.
In every minor, major way before I start writing it, a word.
Well, I think you're a major writer or on the way to being a major writer, and I'm really delighted to have met you
you too.
And that you've agreed to be part of the Writers Mosaic family.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, mate.
No, thanks for having me.
Moses McKenzie was in conversation with Colin Grant for Writers Mosaic. To hear more authors, go to writersmosaic.org.uk.